So, and also just to remind people that these are what the different marble colors represent. So orange is changing line number 9, black is number 8, white is 7, and blue is number 6. So you can make a note.
How does it look?
Yes, with the bag. Yes.
Leather?
And you shake up. And then you draw one. Draw one and write down.
Oh, you think glass. Oh, no, pick glass.
And then put back in. Because, and then shake up again and draw another one. One for each line. But don't take one and put aside. You know.
Why fourth line? Six line.
Pardon?
That is six line. You hear it's a four lines.
Oh, because it's number 6 is change is old yin.
Yeah, yeah.
Number 9 is old yin.
Yeah.
And why don't you draw and then draw the hexagram so then it'll be more obvious. Go ahead.
Yeah,
and
do the hexagram.
Oh, all right. So I will draw to what the for demonstration.
Please.
Okay, first one is black. So then number 8. So
okay.
All right. Then I put another.
Do 6 times.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Yes. 5, 4.
Yeah, yeah.
No, not 4.
Yeah. I can.
7. I mean, so you understand.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
You created this?
No, is actually from a book called Tao of Chaos by Katya Walter. And she also found it some other place. But someone calculated the probability of Yarrow-Stock division. And said that the probability, see with coins, it's just as easy to get 6 as is to get 9. But not so easy to get 6 with euro stocks. It's pretty hard. 1 in 16. And with 9, it's 3 chances in 16 of getting with euro stock division. So this more accurately reflects euro stock division rather than the coins. Because so it's the same chance to get 6 as to get 9 in the coins. Yeah. So anyway, just puts proper
mathematical probability was figured in.
Yeah. So it's like drawing euro stocks very quickly.
I was using spaghetti.
But then if they break, is that a changing line? So, thank you.
Okay. You
please. I have no gifts, only my
handouts.
Okay, so my presentation is different. I hope you don't mind. I've taken the opportunity to discuss the I Ching in terms of my discipline, which is transformative learning. So this presentation is more to answer this question, how does engagement with the I Ching further transformative learning? So how does engagement with the I Ching further transform the civil life? So first of all, I need to explain to you what transformative learning is, the way I mean it. It's a very, compared to the I Ching, it's nothing. Transformative learning actually is less than 30 years old. I Ching is 3,000 years old. Transformative learning is less than 30 years old.
Just 30 years, huh?
Just 30 years. Very young. It is part of the field of education, and education is broken up, at least in one branch, with the philosophy of learning. So education is about what is the philosophy of how we learn. Mm. A particular philosophy of learning is called constructivism. Constructivism means that humanity constructs reality. And this is kind of reaction against the extreme scientific position that the only reality is the reality of material objects out there. This is a big concession for Western thinking, that reality is actually constructed by the negotiations of meaning amongst people.
Mm-hmm.
So transformative learning comes out of that philosophy of learning. Transformative learning also is under the field of adult learning. So in education, there are people who specialize in preschool and in elementary school, etc. This is about adult learning. Transformative learning came from Jack Mesro, who is an educator at Teachers College in, Columbia in New York. He had a study in 1978, which started this whole field. And maybe field is a bit grandiose. It's hardly a field. It's just really beginning. His study in 1978 took hundreds of people, of women, re-entering education at community colleges. There was a big push to try to get women, because of the women's movement, to go back to college. So many of these women hadn't been in school for 20 years, maybe 30 years, and they were very hesitant about coming back to school. Some of them were the first people in their families to ever go to college. So they were very, had an inferiority complex probably about going to school. So what Jack Mesro's big study concluded was that the people who were successful, those women who were successful, had to actually change their assumptions about what learning is about who they are, about their chances to learn. So he said they needed to understand their own history. They needed to understand their culture, their cultural beginnings, all of the things that inform how they think. Because it's in changing your thinking that's going to help you actually learn more deeply. Okay, so that's what transformative learning is. He also came up with this idea, this method. And this method says that when you have a disorienting dilemma, this is like hexagram 38. When you have doubt, it opens the potential for deeper learning. So when you begin with a disorienting dilemma, there's something that you observe or that you experience that makes no sense to you. It's disorienting in that way. It makes you question your assumptions and your beliefs. And the prescription then, the learning prescription is, you need to reason and reflect. And you need to collaborate with other people who may have a different perspective than your own, so that you can see the context in which you come from. If you only hang out with people like yourself, the things that you take for granted about your culture, you can't see. In this way, these educators feel that you can change what they call your meaning schemes and perspectives. So these are the frames of references that constitute meaning for you. And my interest is that the hardest thing to see is through your cultural beliefs and assumptions. For existential reasons, it's very difficult to do that. Okay, so you see, this is the field of transformative learning is in education. It doesn't have a lot of context around it, or content around it. It's about meaning theory. Again, I'm asking the question, does the chain further transformative learning, even this little field? Are there any questions? Okay, so I start with the premise that the I Ching can be a disorienting dilemma for the modern mind, and probably particularly for the Western mind. The I Ching is a disorienting dilemma. But again, when you can plant the seeds of doubt, then the opportunity to deepen the learning is there. Now, I want to make clear that I'm not talking about any particular Westerner. Of course, in this room, we're all enlightened. But take this as generalizations. So why are the paradigms different for I Ching and modern thinking? Well, remember that Dr. Wu gave us this diagram on page 3. In order to know, we take the dynamic between principle and practice and we compare it to the Tao. So this is, you might say, is the paradigm of the Tao, or even traditional or wisdom traditions in the East. And the virtues of that way of thinking are in humility, sincerity, superior beginnings, and perfect communication. If you understand this paradigm, those elements make lots of sense. But if you're just of the modern mind, it's very difficult to grasp what that means. And it's difficult because, as you see on the bottom, where our frames of reference are motivated by science. And I also put engineering and ROI, which stands for return on investment. So, when you think about the last decision that you made, mm-hmm. was it based on the Tao, or was it based on logical coherence or empirical observation? Was it dependent on the least input for the most output? And in other words, was it a decision that you made based on efficiency? I think science and efficiency are the two ways that we come to know or we base our knowledge on. So practice and principle go back and forth, back and forth. We only compare it to science and efficiency, but we have no concept, we being modern people, have no concept of Tao. Everything is about the material. Everything is about the phenomenal. It's not about the inner life. It's the top trigram without the bottom trigram. You know, we forget about the interior self. So on page 4, so I took transformative learning. And the scholarly question for me is not to look at learning history, which is probably, or even learning philosophy per se. I'm really outside of my field, in a sense, because my interest is more philosophical and psychological. But I think that these disciplines will enhance this transformative learning field. So the particular thing that I look at is what thwarts transformative learning. In other words, what prevents us from reflecting and reasoning deeply? And as is true with educators like myself, our laboratory is our classroom. So what I learned was that in our program, the student body is very diverse. We try to recruit for diversity. And I think the founders of the program naively thought we get all these different kinds of people in the room, and if we just get them to reason and reflect, there'll be no problem. You know, they'll be able to see their context. They'll be able to see their personal psychology. They'll be able to see their history. They'll be able to see their cultural frames. But in my experience, they can't, particularly the cultural frames. So then we have lots of conflict. So for example, in some cultures, like American culture, time is precise. You notice in I Ching, we say 3 years. We don't mean 3 years, we mean many, right? But in American culture, when you say three, it means three. So if I say, come at 3 o'clock, some of the students show up at 3 o'clock and expect other students to come at 3 o'clock. Mm-hmm. I have other students from other countries or other subgroups within the United States. 3 o'clock doesn't mean 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock means 4 o'clock, which is fine. you know, we can say, oh, that's a cultural difference. Let's discuss that. But my experience in my classroom is people get upset. They get so upset. The 3 o'clock people who showed up right at 3 o'clock get upset at the people who are later. The people who are so-called later get upset at the precise people for getting so upset. You know, what's the big deal?
Right, you know? Right.
And it becomes a huge conflict.
Yeah.
So the way I understand that, the way I make meaning of that is to take Jungian psychology, particularly its new concept as a contemporary concept of the cultural complex and the cultural unconscious. And that particular concept says that there are unconscious forces going on that are culturally prescribed, but we don't see them. We take them for granted. A complex is something that constellates really high emotion. Once you have that emotional trigger, can you reason? Can you reflect? I see in my classroom, no, not really. You know, they can be civil, you know, sometimes there are huge disagreements because it's very hard to penetrate what is existentially unconscious for you. And yet, you know, your whole way of being is predicated on your culture. So it's very hard for you to be critically engaged with your culture. So, again, transformative learning is saying reason, reflect, but because of the cultural unconscious, there are times when you don't reason or you don't reflect. In fact, you know, the cultural unconscious holds all those things that are contradictory to your own cultural beliefs and keeps them at bay. Okay, we just won't look at that. You know, but when somebody reminds you that there's another way of being, here's another example. You know, in England, in the United States, we queue. You know, if you're at the store, you go in line and you expect the first person to go next person to go next, you know. But Southeast Asia, you know, there's no queuing. You come to a stop sign, people aren't behind each other, they're trying to get in a row, ready to go. But we can get upset by that because it upsets our order, our sense of reality. Okay. So, again, I'm saying that I Ching for modern mind can be disorienting because it's a different paradigm. It's actually maybe reminding us that we don't have an easy experience with inner life. We're very much outer life or materially engaged. And even if we are people who study I Ching and try not to be that way, our institutions, our education, our government, whatever, are saturated with how the cultural archetypes are. So they compel us to act in a certain way, even if we want to change, even if we want to change. So so the rest of my presentation here is more about why it is the Western mind, where's the roots of the Western mind, okay? And compare that with the mind that underlies the I Ching, the wisdom of the I Ching, to see where that disorientation might be. So on page 5, every human culture has its myth. And I don't mean an untruth. I mean the story that it lives through. Okay? It has its myth about how consciousness happened. After all, we were a undiscerning consciousness. We were in oneness. The whole idea of being human is that human beings can discern. They can. And in order to discern, you need to see this and that. You need to be able to distinguish in some way. So, the myth in the West is the duality is good and evil. that's how discernment is made. And so the discernment is about opposition. So everything that gets seen is a candidate for judgment. And one has to understand, is it the truth or is it a heresy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is the consciousness myth that permeates most Western cultures. This is different than the Eastern way of coming to consciousness. That consciousness, the overriding myth, is yin and yang. That's a whole different relationship than good and evil. Yin and yang means the virtue there is to harmonize. Is that yin and yang have a relationship. One isn't trying to get rid of the other. It's a relationship. That is a whole different ontology or different reality than an oppositional reality. And this is the major, I think, difference between Western thinking and Eastern thinking. Even though the West has its proponents of trying to get to balance the objective, subjective self. So you see then that where is humankind's place in the cosmos? In a dualistic oppositional myth, we're going to say human beings are on one side, the divine is on the other. And this is reflected in Western myths as far back as Greeks, where we had Prometheus. Prometheus was the titan who stole fire from the gods and tried to give it to human beings. He is in opposition to Zeus. And in fact, Greek philosophy, he was actually a bad person. It was only in Western romantic philosophy that Prometheus was brought back as a hero. And then we have Adam and Eve, that story, but again, in opposition to the divine. So the whole Western project is about carrying the burden of the lack of perfection in humanity, but trying to take the responsibility of being more perfect. And perfection has to do with ideas. You'll remember Plato and the shadows and the cave. It's the idea that is divine because it's eternal, mm-hmm. universal idea. Okay? So for the Western project, then, abstraction is valued. They want to be abstract because the idea is what is divine. Humanity being less than perfect. So syllogistic logic, you remember Aristotle? His logic says, you know, A and B, if A is good, then B is bad. And so the syllogism is trying to always locate the logical coherence. You know, you can't be both good and bad. You have to be one or the other. Okay, this really contrasts with Eastern philosophy that says heaven and earth need to be harmonized, and humankind plays a role in that. So everything in an Eastern paradigm is in existence, whereas the Western project is to try to be outside of the existence so you can objectify and abstract. Okay? So Eastern is far more concrete. It never separates the heart, mind, and body. In fact, Jung, in a preface to a work called The Secrets of the Golden Flower, which was also translated by Wilhelm, says, the Chinese never separated their heart and mind. And the West separated it, and our whole philosophy is about trying to get it back together. So, whereas the West values syllogistic logic, it's trying to distinguish truth from heresy. In the East, it's trying to harmonize the way of heaven and earth and trying to gain an integral understanding of things that they are. So you'll see that with the I Ching, it's not saying this is good, this is bad, as much as it's saying, hey, sometimes we have resentment, sometimes we have joy, and there are different ways to handle that. So again, why is engaging the I Ching a disorienting dilemma for the modern mind, particularly the modern Western mind? I wanted to emphasize on this page how the I Ching requires us to engage the image and the imaginal. In a way, if you go back to page 5 where I say heaven, humankind, and earth, in Western psychological terms, the earth might be the phenomenal world in one sense, and the heaven could be the inner world. The earth in psychological terms, in Western psychological terms, the earth is, you know, the constraints of everyday life. It's the reality of the material. Whereas heaven is your yearnings, your inner yearnings. So it's there, the outer life and the inner life are quite representative. So back to page 6, to engage the imaginal is an interior process. West is so outer focused, the modern life is so outer focused, that another disorientation of the I Ching is that we really need to give ourselves to the image, to the imaginal. We see this in the Chinese character. I mean, it's a pictograph. And in order to really understand and get all the wisdom from it, we need to give ourselves to the image. The lines, the trigrams, the hexagrams, they're talked about in terms that involve nature, in terms that involve the body, in terms that involve the social hierarchy and social order, and inner and outer life. But it is it's an imaginal, metaphoric, storied way. So it's a different, what we might call in philosophy, a different epistemology, a different method of understanding reality. The commentaries also are in the same language. Now compare that with outside of the box. I take a quote from a Western philosopher, actually a critic who critiques the Western philosophy. I quote him as saying, in Genesis it is suggested that the birth of the human power of imagining coincides with Adam's transgression of God's law. And in the modern Western narrative, there's a partition between real and the imaginal, between subjectivity and objectivity, between heart and mind. So the first part of that quote, this is part of Western cosmology, that humankind was excommunicated from paradise, and that its imperfect understanding is the imaginal. And this is, in a way, a bad thing because it is imperfect. God doesn't have to imagine, he knows. So there's a bias against the inner subjective imaginal, even from a mythological point of view. And again, you know, modern people would deny that they, and especially in the secular West, would deny that they are informed by these mythologies. But they are we are informed by them unconsciously. And so in the Western narrative, again, even with all of the people, all of the Western philosophers that try to make a project out of it, there is this uncomfortable relationship between subjectivity and objectivity. Objective is real. Our inner life is prone to fantasy. So there's this prejudice against the imaginal. And here, when we go to the I Ching, we're asked to actually give to the image. So again, from a cultural paradigmatic point of view, it can be disorienting. So on page 7, I have us go through descent. And I picked this one because resentment is, to me, like the disorienting dilemma. And remember, transformative learning starts with this disorienting dilemma. It says, what are you supposed to do? So, again, you can easily see it's the lake above, the water below. And again, I think the beauty of it, and I'll just, because you know this one, I'll just do it briefly and come back to it later. But you even see in the character a tree bounded. That's a whole different understanding of resentment. You know, you can feel it in your body, you can feel the balance. It's different than if I just say the word, the self. You know, it involves you more into what this word means. And then you have the water that drains into the lake. And I tell you, I'm beginning to see the symbology in these lines now. I'm beginning to see, oh, that, of course, that's the lake I see. You know, I can see the ripples of the water. I can see the bed of the lake, you know. Then there's the bottom that is about water and danger. So again, if we had more time, I would point out that we have such rich imagery. We have the buttocks, and that's about sitting in resentment. We have the red knee covers, meaning the rulers. You know, again, the image that's evoked informs us in a different way than if we just said words. Offering sacrifice, you know, that's based on history and tradition. Again, we know something more deeply. And so on. Let me just go through the summary, and the italicized in each step is the summary. So, line one, don't act, don't move. In a way, transformative learning is trying to say that. It's saying, now stop, reflect, reason, you know, don't act. Cultivate your virtue. Totally missing in transformative learning. wait for help. Don't wish for quick achievement. Insincerity of your mind. Watch for warnings and be cautious. On page 9, I want to go through a little timeline. This is a timeline about the Puritans, which was a religious sect. They were what we call the pilgrims who first came to this country from New England in 1620. Their whole history is about resentment. And the idea is, when I go through their history, think about the I Ching's instructions about resentment. But keep in mind that, of course, the Puritans come from a Western context. And the Western context is always about opposition, finding who's right and who's wrong. Okay, so now on page 9, you see in the corner the good, evil symbol, kind of gray, knowing, and that symbolizes that the myth of opposition always is underlying, is one way to interpret Western history. Okay. So the Puritans, you have to understand that the Reformation is the time when the Christian religion in the West was splitting into two factions, one with the Catholics and one with the Protestants. Mm-hmm. So we have opposition already, not with land, but with an idea, with ideas and power. Who's going to own it? Well, out of that opposition, the English started their own church, the Anglican Church. They did not want to be under the Pope. They didn't trust the clergy. As a matter of fact, they ended up killing the Archbishop of Canterbury and killing the king and starting from there. But because they wanted to make peace with the Catholics, because there were still Catholics in the country, they came up with the agreement, the Elizabethan settlement of 1859. When they settled, the Puritans found that they had opposition in their own ranks. There were the nationalists and the congregationalists. Congregationalists said, we don't want any church above us, even the nationalist church. We just want our congregations to govern themselves. It's only when God speaks to us directly in our congregations that we know what to do. So we don't want this nationalist church. And then there was a separatist movement, and the solid Puritans saw these people as being treasonous. So they were killed. They were put, thrown in jail. Talk about resentment. They were killed. Or tried for treason. So things were not so good for the Puritan separatists. So they had this idea of going to Holland and thinking that in Holland they wouldn't be persecuted. But these poor people, you have to have some compassion for them, because they some unscrupulous ship captains said, oh yeah, we'll take you to Holland. They took their money and then turned them in. You know, oh, here they are. You know, so they got, those poor Puritans got paraded in the streets. Captains took the money and never took them to Holland. Another story from one of the original journals says that one of the Dutch ship captains said, okay, I will take you to Holland. But he was late in coming, and the people that were waiting began to disperse. But when he came and saw what was happening, he sent out the rowboat to go pick up the people that were still on the beach and take them onto the ship, the idea being he would go after the other ones when they recongregated. But before they could recongregate, the authorities started rounding up the people that were left. So you can imagine what happened. Fathers and mothers were separated. Husbands and wives were separated. Children were left behind. Some were on the ship, you know. Terrible, terrible. Some, they made it to Holland. They stayed, they finally regrouped. But in Holland, they didn't speak Dutch. The Dutch were very urbane. They stayed there for 11 years. They couldn't prosper because they didn't know the language. They did not. They were rather against the liberalness of the Dutch. Their children were, people died there, you know, within that time period. Their teenage children began to drift away, thinking, who wants to be a Puritan? I want to be Dutch.
Yeah.
You know? And so then they said, okay, let's go to the New World. And that was no easy decision. Because even once they got there, of 100 people only, 50 people survived the first winter, and of that, only seven people were healthy enough to actually take care of people. So, you know, it was not an auspicious beginning for the West or for America. But again, think in terms of the settlement and what the I Ching says about it, and how difficult it is to translated into a context that has so much opposition. So again, why it would be a disorienting goal. Okay, so what would I conclude from all of this, though? You know, what would I conclude in this context of transformative learning? I think that in studying the I Ching, and if you can give yourself to the images of it, you can actually think of transformative learning as having a direction. And the direction is trying to heal the inner opposition of the inner life and outer life in the Western psyche, sort of regaining the ground of our being. And, you know, certainly Western philosophers have been trying to do this. Kant and Heidegger, Harness, most recently, who's a faculty member here. What Tarnas concludes, as a matter of fact, is, you know, there's too much patriarchal energy in Western thinking, and that even though you've gotten so much good out of Western thinking because of science and whatnot, that the feminine needs to be returned to Western consciousness in order for there to be harmony within that part of consciousness. So then I say, can engaging the I Ching in the West heal the polarities, allow the paradoxes, dissolve opposition, cast no blame, and yet inspire integral action? I think the danger of the West not transforming is that it's always looking to blame the other, the person that's different. And I think, you know, both the situation in Iraq and with the immigration legislation, we can't seem to divorce ourselves from the evildoers or from punitive measures. So I think the danger, again, West not trying to find its own harmony is its castigation of the other as a cultural complex not integrating its own opposition within. So turn back to page 7, and I'll conclude here, is that if we see resentment not as something coming from outside, but our own modern consciousness, the resentment of non-integration between inner and outer life, this trigram really speaks to me. In that, the two major lines, 2 and 5, they're not in harmony, and they're young lines. You know, that makes me imagine the hexagram saying, okay, West, you've got too much yang, and need to think about the yin. The other way it makes me think of the West, and of course this is all my own imagining, is that the lower trigram, which is the inner life, is danger. And I think in the Western tradition, the unconscious dark has always been the abyss rather than as the opportunity to transform. And again, you know, cultivating virtue and waiting for help. Waiting for help to me is more about the imaginative intuition that can help us, I think, reimagine how we might be.
Take a few minutes, please. Okay.